It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum are sparking retaliatory tariffs on certain U.S. goods like cheese. We'll talk with the president of Wisconsin's Sartori Cheese about how tariffs are affecting business. First, the public will get the chance to weigh in this week on whether two spaces at UW-Madison's Memorial Union should be renamed. The Porter Butts Gallery and Frederick March Play Circle are named after prominent people with long-term connections to the UW, but a recent report found they had ties to a campus Ku Klux Klan organization. After the deadly violence last summer at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank commissioned a review of campus groups that were named after or had links to Klan organizations. The report came out in April. It did not specifically recommend renaming the Memorial Union spaces. Now, the governing body of the union, called the Union Council, is meeting throughout the summer to determine what to do about those two spaces. Allison Geyer is a staff writer at Isthmus. She wrote the recent cover story, Facing UW-Madison's Racist Past. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a little background on the two people at the middle of this, Porter Butts and Frederick March. Prominent names on this campus.
Yeah, absolutely. Names that people would recognize, both people who made significant contributions to the university. Frederick March is an award-winning, Academy Award-winning and Tony Award-winning actor. And Porter Butts was a prominent art historian who was responsible for founding the Memorial Union and launching the larger movement for college unions across the nation.
And now talk about the background they had, it turns out, links to a campus group called the Ku Klux Klan. Talk about this group and where it fits into the national picture.
Yeah, so this is a group that, you know, based on what we can tell from archival records, was active on campus from about 1919 through the early 1920s. And it was called Ku Klux Klan, and, you know, by all accounts and based on everything that's been written about it, it was a fraternal organization. It was comprised of some of the most elite members of fraternities on campus, student leaders, athletes, those kind of people. There's no evidence anywhere in the archives that they had racist views, but it was part of kind of a pervasive kind of widespread bigotry that was really prominent back in that era.
Right, you said in your piece, you said this in the context of the history at the time. This was in the time of a great revival of the name of the Ku Klux Klan across the Midwest in a lot of ways.
Yes, yeah, and what was interesting about this second Klan, certainly there was the first Klan that we know about that happened after the Civil War, but this Klan was kind of brought back during the 19-teens, and it was prominent in the North and in larger cities, and so it really isn't this kind of backwoods, you know, rural, uneducated people that were bigoted. It was, you know, very prominent, you know, middle-class Americans, educated people, doctors, lawyers, police officers.
Now the question is, what does the university, what does the union do about this? I understand there are forums coming up over the next couple of days to review these issues.
Yeah, tomorrow and Thursday. And, you know, the Union Council, that's the governing body of the Memorial Union. It's made up of trustees, adults, and students. And they really have to weigh this difficult decision. You know, students have filed complaints about this on campus, saying that it creates a hostile environment for students of color. But there is also, you know, a group of people that feel very strongly that, you know, these you know, Porter Butts and Frederick March made great contributions, and that legacy should not be erased. And, you know, the question that they have to kind of contend with is, can you judge someone based on the standards of today? And what do you do with this? And, you know, do their better, you know, the work that they did later in life, and, you know, they went on to, you know, champion progressive causes. You know, what does that, how does that factor into this conversation?
Talking about Allison Geyer from Isthmus, she wrote about a controversy at the UW-Madison's Memorial Union. Spaces there named after people, prominent people, as she was saying, in UW history, who were affiliated with a Ku Klux Klan organization back around 1920. You got a lot of ranges of response in your piece. I want to talk about some of them. You talked to I think, a group that performs in the theater that was kind of surprised to find out what the name was connected to.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was, you know, a very, you know, inclusive. It was a group of South Asian sisters. That is what the former name of it. It's now called Yoni Kibat. And it's kind of basically a South Asian vagina monologues. And, you know, everything that they are about is about diversity and inclusion. And so the juxtaposition of, you know, learning about a KKK group with ties to the space that they were performing in. It was just a very vivid contrast, and it was upsetting to a lot of people.
So how do they approach that when they did a performance in that space?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the interesting reactions, I think. They decided to kind of actively reclaim the space, acknowledge the history and, you know, the revelation, and inform their audience about, you know, these historical ties and what they want to do, and, you know, kind of proactively taking up space, and kind of, you know, that is their form of resistance. And I think that made a lot of people feel empowered to do that.
You also talked to Porter Butts's daughter, Cheryl Randall, I think was her name.
Yeah.
And what was her perspective on all of this?
Well, and she was very upset. I mean, imagine finding out that your father, you know, was a part of this group. I mean, certainly this had been written about, but just to have it kind of splash on the pages of newspapers. And she, of course, you know, loves and knows her father and wanted to do what she could to really get to the bottom. You know, what can we say about this group? What were their views? What were her father's views back at that time? So it really sparked an investigation on her part. She and her husband went to the archives and dug up old editorials from the Daily Cardinal, you know, looked into the Badger yearbook where the KKK groups had pages, and kind of did her own investigation, and actually found that her father had either written or approved an editorial condemning the Klan in the mid-1920s.
Right, and part of what comes through in the piece you wrote is how much we don't know about, obviously, what people were thinking, but there's fairly little public evidence of their motivations in being part of this group at the time.
Right, and I think, and the UW study does a really good job of laying this out, just the importance of taking a step back and looking at the widespread bigotry that was common at that time. You had on campus fraternities, which were basically de facto white segregated, and they did, you know, minstrel shows. They did blackface. Porter Butts actually, you know, in addition to being on staff at the Daily Cardinal, worked for a university publication called The Octopus that published extraordinarily racist cartoons. And so it was a very different time. But I think one really important thing is I spoke to a historian who talked about how people involved in the Klan did not consider it to be a racist organization. It was akin to the Elks or the Moose.
But at the same time, and this was a national organization, it was known to be, at that time, as I understand it, very anti-immigrant in
right.
particular. And you talked to Linda Gordon, I think, former
yes,
UW
yes.
researcher, about what it meant to be part of this organization. What kind of things did she say?
Yeah, well, and she really wanted to emphasize the fact that it was, you know, urban, educated people. And they were people who, you know, under the trappings of patriotism, wanted to promote 100% Americanism. And that meant basically not supporting immigrants and, you know, being suspicious of Jews and Catholics. And I think that was widely considered acceptable back then in a way that, you know, we look back and it's kind of shocking.
Can you talk about why now? Because as you write in your piece, people have known about the existence of this group on campus at the time. Talk about the timing, 2018, and why this is such a hot issue now.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely resurfacing. Everything that we've seen with the rise of white supremacy, neo-Nazi groups openly parading in the streets, similar to what was happening back in the 1920s, a wave of populism, anti-immigrant sentiment. And, you know, in response to that, we've seen a lot of grassroots activism and organizing, making an effort to eradicate racism and make sure these things don't happen again. And you're seeing, you know, here in Madison, we had the debates over the Confederate monuments, and on other college campuses, there are other monuments commemorating slave owners and segregationists and, you know, people whose views we now think of as abhorrent. And so there's a reframing of our history that's happening right now. And it's a very controversial topic.
You mentioned those forums this week, looking at these spaces and who they're named after. As we wrap up, what is the timeline?
Well, they're going to be making their decision this fall, I think by December. The Union Council is continuing to meet over the summer, which is somewhat unusual for them since the, you know, school is out. They're working with you know, marketing team to think about creating some transparent signage, working on making a social justice center. There's going to be a history exhibition So I think the university is taking a really holistic approach to this, but the ultimate question is whether or not they will rename the spaces.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Geyer is a staff writer at ISMIS. We talked with her about the debate over whether two spaces at UW-Madison's Memorial Union that are named after members, past members of a campus KKK organization should be renamed. First, Wisconsin cheese producers are expressing concern about President Trump's approach to tariffs. Trump imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum from American allies, including Mexico and Canada. This past Friday, he also began imposing tariffs on more than 1,000 goods from China. In response, countries have hit back with tariffs on U.S. products, including Wisconsin cranberries, apples, Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and cheese. The White House says it's trying to protect American workers and make the playing field more level, but our next guest says tariffs often backfire, and if this goes on for too long, the damage could spread beyond his company. Jeff Schwager is the president of Sartori Cheese, based in the Sheboygan County city of Plymouth. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
We have this tariff by Mexico, 15% on Wisconsin cheese, scheduled to go up further. You do a fair amount of business there, I understand. What does this mean for Sartori?
Well, the tariff actually did go up last Friday to 20 to 25%, depending on the type of cheese that's going. So for us, what it means is all of a sudden our product is 20 to 25% more expensive. What we've agreed to with our partners in Mexico, meaning our customers and our importers, is we're going to split the tariffs for a while to have very limited impact on the Mexican consumer. But that means that business that was profitable to us is now break even at best.
How big a part of your business goes to Mexico?
When we look at the export business for Sartori is about 12% of our revenue. Mexico right now is our number one export market, and it's about a third of our export business. So it's 3 or 4% of the business.
And how about looking to the north? We're seeing various tariffs coming in or threatened by Canada now. Are you seeing an impact on your business there?
You've got the tariffs. We are seeing an impact there, but it's from a different issue. There's an agreement that's been signed called CETA, which is the Canadian-European Trade Agreement, and they've adjusted product that can come in under a supply-side management program, where it used to be about 60% was European product, 40% was rest of the world. With this new agreement, it is 70% European product, 30% rest of the world. So for us to take cheese up there without duty or tariff, it's seen a significant reduction. And tariff above that in Canada is 250 to 274%, which basically puts you out of the market if you have to pay duty to get product in there.
Now, as I understand the cheese business, the cheese you start making today doesn't hit the shelves tomorrow. This is a long-term planning business for a lot of your product. How does trade uncertainty affect the decisions you're making?
Uncertainty is the killer. I mean, we're sitting on inventory from cheese we made a year ago that we thought was going to, you know, when we made it, there were certain trade rules in place. You know, now, we don't know when we look at these tariffs, are they going to be here for a month? Are they going to be here for 3 months, 3 years? Because we've got to make decisions on product we make today for what we're going to need a year from now.
Are you at a point where you're saying, okay, we need to buy less milk, we need to schedule a little less production to account for the sales we might lose in especially a place like Mexico?
We've made the decision here at Sartori that we are going to continue to buy. We buy 100% of the milk from 130 dairy farms. We're going to continue to do that every day. And we will figure out how to deal with that inventory if this would continue going forward. You know, and when you look at it from an industry perspective, I think, you know, Sartori's pretty fortunate with the type of products we make because it's all more specialty cheese. There will be a market for it. The price may go down. And unfortunately, if the price on cheese goes down, milk is the major ingredient. The milk price will be threatened in the future, and it's already been low for the last 3 years.
Is there a hope that domestic consumption can make up any slack that you might get from having these higher prices in foreign markets?
You would hope, but I think that's pretty limited. I mean, if you look, the U.S. Dairy Export Council has looked out with the National Milk Producers Foundation of where milk consumption, whether it's fluid, cheese, or yogurt, or any of the other dairy-based products, are exports have to grow. It's our fastest-growing segment, and without that, we're going to have a surplus of milk. It's just there's not enough domestic consumption for it.
Talking to Jeff Schwager, president of Sartori Cheese, about trade and tariffs. Jeff, you're concerned, obviously, about this escalating back and forth tariff battle that's going on right now. That said, are there things in other countries, Mexico, Canada, the European Union, that you point to and say, yeah, these are genuine grievances for the American dairy industry?
I mean, without a doubt. I mean, when you look at NAFTA, I think the general perception is that it's a free trade agreement. But Canada has been allowed with the original NAFTA agreement that to have a supply side management side of it that hit with class 7 milk and has always been there with cheese. And when you think about that, it really isn't free trade. We believe that there should be free trade no matter where we are, and let the consumer, in whether it's here in the United States or any country, make the decision on what product they want to buy. You shouldn't have to decide based upon, what the tariff is that sets the price in a market. Canada, or if you look at Mexico right now, they've got a free trade agreement with the European Union. We've got these tariffs. Our product is now 20 to 25% more expensive than the European product. Over time, our customers are going to migrate to the European product, and it'll take us years to get back on grocery store shelves or into recipes in restaurants.
Another issue you've been concerned about is how cheeses are named. It might sound like a small issue, but it's a pretty big deal in some markets. What's going on, and how's that affecting you?
That's what's called geographic indicators. Most people think that Europe use the term Parmesan or Asiago, and they did in some standard, but they've gone out and negotiated trade agreements to have protection for those names where we can no longer use them. We make more Parmesan, we make more Asiago, we make more feta than the European companies do by quite a large amount. So we've made a market for them, and now they're trying to keep us out of those markets going forward. If you think about it, the United States is a third of the world's economy today. Europe's a third, and the rest of the world's a third. 15 years out, we'll be maybe 20 to 25% of the world's economy. Europe will be 20 to 25%, and the rest of the world will be 50 to 60%. When that happens, if they've locked us out of those dairy markets, and it's not just dairy, they're doing some things with sausage and other things too, their businesses are going to be able to grow, and the United States isn't. A lot of people think geographic indicators are something that's been around forever. It's quite the opposite. They were first conceived when the European Union was formed in the mid to late 90s. It was a way to get France, Italy, Spain to join the European Union, to join the Central European countries and the Northern European countries, to give them some protection. And they've seen that, and they're trying to apply that around the world, really in violation of intellectual property laws. I mean, you should be, you use the term Parmesan Reggiano. It's trademarked. Nobody else should be able to use that because they've gone out and gotten trademarks on it. Asiago, on the other hand, they want the same protection without a trademark just because it's the name of a town in Italy where a particular type of cheese was made. But they can't get trademarks on it, so they've come up with a different way to keep us out of the markets. This has just hit us in Mexico, where in this European agreement that was signed, Asiago we can no longer use. We have to call it Sartiago now. The consumer doesn't know what that is. We've seen about a 30% reduction in our Asiago sales in the first 3 months that's been in place. We're no longer going to be able to use the term Parmesan in Mexico, but we can use the Spanish equivalent. We can use Parmesano.
With these issues in mind, I don't want to speak for the Trump administration, but I think the hope of kind of a get-tough policy starting with the steel and aluminum tariffs is not that we end up in this never-ending spiral of tariff escalation, but that by getting tough, we get a negotiating point to clear up some of these issues, to negotiate over how things are named, over the Canadian dairy industry. Are you hopeful that this tough trade policy from the Trump administration will get some of the freer trade policies that you're looking for?
We are very hopeful that that's where we end up. And, you know, I think you're making a great point. If this gets people to the negotiating table and we can get things resolved for the long haul, it's great for, you know, U.S. dairy, but it's also great, you know, for the United States overall long term.
Are you worried that that's not what's going to happen?
I think eventually it will happen. The question is how long is it going to take? And that's the uncertainty that creates havoc in the business world right now.
We'll leave it there. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Schwager is president of Plymouth-based Sartori Cheese. We talked about his concerns over retaliatory tariffs on cheese. Coming up after the news, a new survey shows that Americans are concerned about the state of democracy, no matter their income bracket, race, or political party. We'll talk to a reporter about the poll results and more, and you can share your thoughts. By the way, we have something special coming up this Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. I'm co-hosting a special program on trade and tariffs. You can get us started right now on our callback line at 833-424-3327. Do tariffs affect you? If you're a dairy farmer, are you worried about the Canadian pricing system we were just hearing about? Call and share your thoughts at 833-424-3327. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. First, a recent bipartisan poll shows that many Americans are concerned about the state of our democracy. 8 in 10 of those surveyed said they're either very or somewhat worried about the future of representative government in America, and 68% believe democracy is getting weaker. James Holman is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's also the author of The Daily 202 for The Washington Post, where he wrote about the results of this poll. James, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, tell us a little bit about this poll. It's Freedom House, which studies democracy around the world, and then a couple of names from both sides of the partisan spectrum.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Two notable names teamed up. Joe Biden, the former vice president, and George W. Bush, from his presidential library, both signed on to this project. They hired an impressive group of Republican and Democratic pollsters to work with Freedom House. And typically, Freedom House does really sophisticated academic studies in places like Zimbabwe to monitor attitudes about democracy, whether authoritarianism is on the rise or the decline. And this time, they felt like they needed to do this kind of exploration in the United States. And the results.
I think we've lost our Skype connection with James Holman. Not hearing him right now. Talking to James Holman from The Washington Post about this survey on democracy and attitudes toward it in the United States, whether people fear for the future of representative government in the country. You can join in at 888-202. No, that's the pledge drive number. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Are you concerned? Do you think that democratic norms are being eroded in America? Do you worry about the future? Is it important to you to live in a democracy? And let's, definition-wise, the general notion of representative government, the broad definition in the dictionaries, as we hopefully reconnect with our guest, James Holman. James, can you hear me? James, are you there? Nope. So we'll try to reconnect with him. In the meantime, I'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. This poll found concerns, worries about the future of representative government in the United States, but pretty positive attitudes toward it, though variation by generations along the way. I'll remind you that we've got a special coming up on Sunday afternoon with our colleagues at the CBC in Canada, looking at trade and tariffs, big issues in Wisconsin, big issues in Canada as well, in manufacturing, dairy, and more. You can weigh in with your thoughts on that issue at 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327. Do you see tariffs affecting you now or in the future? What do you think of the way President Trump is handling trade issues? Do you have thoughts on the Canadian side of things? Call our callback line and share your thoughts at 833-424-3327. Now, we will hopefully soon continue our conversation about this new survey on the state of democracy here in the United States. And you can call in 800-642-1234. Take a short break now. Hopefully things will go better afterward. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. James Holman is with us, national correspondent and author of the Daily 202, the Washington Post political newsletter, looking at a bipartisan poll, looking at attitudes toward representative government, democracy in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have confidence in the future of representative government in the United States? James, we have you back with us. Let's get back into this poll now. What were some of the main findings about Americans' hopes and fears? And James is gone again. Okay. I don't know what's going on at the Washington Post or at our end. Let's take some of your calls now. We have Monte on the line in West B. Hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
I'd just like to say I'm a long-term Democrat / independent. And during this last election, it was just very disappointing to me how the DNC kind of rigged the election against Bernie. And I think Bernie would have easily beaten Trump in the overall election, only the DNC didn't allow it to happen, which I felt to be very undemocratic. And, yeah, so that's how I feel about it.
All right. Thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. Looking for your thoughts on the future of democracy in America. A survey asked people what they thought. Okay, I think we have James Holman with us this time. James, do we have you?
I'm here.
Okay.
I don't know what was going on.
Me neither, but let's just go with it. This survey, there were fears among many Americans across the political spectrum. What kind of things were we hearing from Americans when they were asked about the future of democracy?
Americans don't have confidence like they used to that democracy is necessarily sustainable or as important as they used to think it was. There were a lot of different ways they tried to get at those questions. One way was asking on a scale of 1 to 10 how important is democracy. Older folks tend to say 10, most important thing. Younger people, not so much. Also, there's less confidence in democracy as the best form of government among minority communities, among other disadvantaged communities, people with lower incomes, because they feel like they've been left behind. And there's kind of this feeling that the system is failing them, and that's creating a crisis of confidence and potentially a crisis of legitimacy. And it's something both Bush and Biden are very worried about.
And one of the questions asked specifically about, is the United States in danger of becoming a non-democratic authoritarian country? What kind of things did people say?
Yeah, a lot of people think it is. A lot of people, a growing number, even compared to a couple of years ago, think that there's a real risk that we're going to lose our democracy altogether. And some of that, is people who dislike Donald Trump think he's a bad guy, think he's an authoritarian. That there's definitely some of that, but there's something deeper in the numbers, and it to some degree crosses party lines. Even people who approve of the president worry that our system is much more fragile. And not that many years ago, there was the sense that we could get through rough times, bad times. We made it through the 2008 financial crisis. No one was worried we were going to devolve into an authoritarian government, which was a fear during the Great Depression in the 1930s. But there's the sense that we can't necessarily count on keeping the system that we are so accustomed to.
One common theme, it looks like, that came up in focus groups and the surveys, a lot of people worried about the influence of money in politics, and more broadly, the idea that the wealthy and influential had more influence on the actions of government than everyday people.
A lot of Republicans felt that, too. It's really notable that just the Citizens United decision, the floodgates have opened with so much money pouring into politics, and people really have this sense, and they're not necessarily wrong, that the rich are more represented by government than they are. And that feeds the sense that democracy is not working for them, that it's not really a true democracy, because if you're rich, you can have access to politicians to a greater degree than normal folks. And so that came up. They asked 14 different issues. They said, how important is this? Do you think, you know, they asked a lot of kind of, do you think this or this A, B situation? And money and politics and race issues really came to the top of the pile in terms of what people feel like is putting the democracy at risk.
Yeah, we heard from D on Facebook, who said, nothing but money seems to matter anymore. Now, you, I'm kind of curious about your perspective on this, because you're really in the daily grind of Washington politics, James. And what's it like to step back and see these bigger picture issues? Is this something that politicians in D.C. are thinking about and aware of?
People know that there's a crisis of legitimacy, Republicans and Democrats, because you have to remember, you know, no Republican in Washington, D.C. thought Donald Trump was going to win. And the Republican establishment, as it's often called, was really just taken aback by the Trump movement, the strength of his support. And it's funny now, because Trump hasn't done anything on campaign finance, but a huge part of his appeal in 2015 and 2016 was, I'm not like those guys in Washington, and I can't be bought and paid for because I have so much money, I don't need donors. And that resonated with a lot of voters. I remember covering Trump rallies across the country, including in Wisconsin, and hearing that over and over again. And so I think there's a real sense among D.C. insiders that something is broken. They can't quite understand it, and everyone always wants to explain dysfunction, you know, with their politically preferred solution. but I think this poll validates what everyone is seeing, which is clearly there's still a great unease in the country. And, you know, if you think about it, this might be another change election in 2018. Historically in the United States, you've obviously had change elections, but 2006, 2008, 2010, 2014, 2018, all of those could be years when control of one body of Congress flips. And that just captures what I think we're seeing in this poll, which is people feel like the democracy, the system that we live in, isn't serving them. And it creates a host of long-term problems for the country, especially because democracy legitimately is in retreat across the world.
Talking to James Holman from The Washington Post about American attitudes toward representative government, to democratic ideals. Big new survey looks at it, finds people worried across the country, across the political spectrum. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, thank you.
What do you want to bring up, Michael?
I believe that right now, obviously, is a super divisive time in our country, and there's strife across the world. And as you just said, there is a receding feeling of democracy across the world, and people feel underrepresented. But I feel like there's hope for the future, because as you look at the young people in this nation and around the world, you see progressive ideology and hope in their eyes. And I think, you know, every generation as they come up through the world affects change in their own way. But I really think as millennials and Generation Z come through, that we will see significant and lasting change.
And Michael, can I ask what generation you are, you're part of, or consider yourself part of?
I consider myself part of the millennial generation.
Okay, Michael, thank you so much. So kids these days, James, are the hope for the future, he says.
Well, yeah, and you know, and Michael has an important point. And the kids are all right. We saw the activism after the shooting in Parkland, Florida. We've seen people get engaged. And I think there's sort of a generation of people who are a little cynical about politics. There were a lot of people who supported Barack Obama in 2008. And felt like he didn't fundamentally transform our nation's politics as they had hoped for, and I think maybe became more realistic, more pragmatic about what was achievable. I think there were a lot of people who supported Trump in 2016 who thought that he would really change Washington, and he has not. in a lot of ways. And so I think it's inspiring sometimes to look at the millennial generation, but there's also a lot of people who I think have been very hopeful and have become embittered or cynical because of the failure of politicians in both parties in Washington to address a lot of our intractable, big, pressing national problems.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Dave in Chippewa Falls. Dave, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dave?
Well, I had the honor of serving in the state legislature 25 years ago for a couple of terms. And one of the big things you're talking about, you know, representative democracy. People, I think, need to understand that you elect these people. You go to the polls. You elect them to represent you, to speak for you. And if you don't go to the polls, don't bitch. Okay? And it just frustrates me so much because I hear from people I know don't even bother to vote. And this, you don't have time to research the issues. This is what you elect people to do. We can have discourse, but you know something? When it all comes down to it, we have the same goal at the end.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Former legislator there, James, and he sees maybe people disengaged from the electoral process, but still ready to complain about the outcomes.
Right. And he's right at the point that their turnout was lower in, you know, Mitt Romney got more votes in Wisconsin, I'm pretty sure, than Donald Trump did. And he lost Wisconsin to President Obama by like 7 points. And it's because turnout was much lower, and it's because people were checked out and disenthused. People don't feel like their vote makes a difference. And those are things that really worry people who genuinely care on across the ideological spectrum about protecting our democracy. Because if people don't feel like their vote is going to count, it is a huge problem because it means that they're not going to necessarily respect the duly elected governments who lead them. And we're seeing elections have consequences. You know, that's I know there were a lot of people in Wisconsin in 2016 who didn't vote because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, perhaps. And Ron Johnson got elected. And whatever you think of Ron Johnson, as we heard some sound a minute ago, he is a key vote on the Supreme Court. If Ron Johnson wasn't in the Senate right now, if Russ Feingold was, Trump would have to nominate a much more moderate Supreme Court justice nominee in order to get them confirmed, because Republicans only have 51 seats, and Democrats have 49. And so those races in 2016 were so close, and it is a sign, if they needed any more, that people's votes really do count. And when people check out of the process and lose faith, it sort of almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Dave, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Don with us in Rhinelander. Don, hi.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I guess I have 4 points that kind of have me not being so faithful with thinking that democracy should last very long. And the first one, a couple you already hit on, one being the campaign finance reform being gone, and the fact that big money seems to be having the rule of the day. The second one kind of being that the gerrymandering, there's a lot of districts where I think people's vote doesn't count anymore. Mm-hmm. And then thirdly, you have the, again, investigative reporting. Just, you know, when somebody tries to come up with something that appears to be a little bit negative, it gets shot down right away. And then the last thing, which kind of encompasses them all, is, and again, it's probably big money and or local governments, but you have such things as the campaign finance reform, which, if I understand right, big money was able to go in there and find loopholes or find things in it that, even though it was considered legal and it would pass the test of the Supreme Court at one time, they could find loopholes and have lawyers that would be able to pick it apart and finally get it thrown out.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. We also heard from Brandy on Facebook, who also mentioned the gerrymandering, dark money, and what she says is a slow decline of checks and balances weakening the republic. Don had a lot there for us, James. He talked about the media a little bit, and that was covered in this survey. And this is where you saw a bigger partisan divide when asked about problems. You mentioned that they listed a bunch of issues, a big divide over the role of the media itself.
Yeah, and the media's credibility matters. You know, we're only as strong as our reputation, and it is important. There obviously is a crisis of confidence, and it's an institution that doesn't have the same trust overall as it used to. Obviously, the media is not a monolith. You and I work for more respectable, trustworthy institutions, although some people don't necessarily think that. And so it's important that the press do investigative reporting. Our slogan at the Washington Post is that democracy dies in darkness, and we think it, you know, one hallmark of strong democracies is a strong free press, and we're trying to do our part no matter who's in charge. And one of the problems, I think, is that the president goes around calling the press fake news when the stories are accurate, and so his supporters sort of become habituated to not trust the press, and then when there are important stories, people don't know who to trust, and the fact that people aren't sort of universally accepted as honest brokers, umpires trying to call balls and strikes, is deleterious for our democracy.
Thanks for the call. Go next to Ron in Norwalk. Ron, hi.
Yay. Hi, Rob. I just wanted your guest comment on, I think there's a line being blurred between capitalism, which is economic system, and democracy, which is a governing system, and they seem to be kind of blending together, and I just wanted to get your comment from your guest on that. Thank you.
That's a good point. It's a great point. We're sort of a capitalistic system. When you look at someone like Bernie Sanders, people often call him a socialist, but Bernie likes to be called a democratic socialist because he believes in democracy and kind of more robust government performing more services. And, you know, one of the interesting things is the last time our democracy was really, truly under threat was the 1930s, when it was kind of under threat from the right and the left. People didn't think that democracy could handle the problems of the Great Depression. And the New Deal, which was in some ways widely dismissed at the time as socialism, was kind of a much more robust government, was crucial to save the democratic system. So a move away from unfettered laissez-faire capitalism. And you could end up certainly seeing something like that again.
Thanks for that call. As we wrap up, the survey also looked at messaging about what might inspire people to embrace democratic ideals, maybe, again, not the Democratic Party, but the spirit of representative government, and the idea of use it or lose it. Exercise your rights or you'll lose them seemed to be the most appealing to people.
And it sort of makes sense, right? You do have a use it or lose it situation. You've got to participate, as one of the callers said. If you don't vote, you don't count, unfortunately, and it is a good way to motivate people. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Obviously, our system's imperfect. People win and lose elections. People get angry. We have more and more partisanship, and a lot of times less civility. But if you participate, you can be the change, even if you don't always get the outcome you want, to be a part of the process and to have people feel buy-in. And that was a consistent theme that came up in a lot of these focus groups and the polls that they did around the country. And the Bush folks and the Biden folks say that they're going to continue to work together on initiatives to that spirit going forward.
Thanks a lot to James Holman from The Washington Post joining us to talk about this survey on American attitudes toward representative government. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're looking for some input for you on issues of tariffs and trade, and you can share your thoughts on our callback line at 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-IDEAS. Here's a couple questions to get you started. What do you think of President Trump's moves to raise tariffs on foreign products? Do you think he's making the right moves on trade or not? And how about Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau? Do you have thoughts on his leadership on trade issues? And do you see tariffs having an impact on your work or your community now or in the future? Call 833-424-3327. Here's the deal. We're working with our Canadian colleagues at the CBC on a special two-hour broadcast this Sunday afternoon from 3 to 5. It'll be an international exchange program. One of their hosts and one of our hosts, me, are going to talk to you and talk to experts on both sides of the border. And we're really hoping to share your thoughts as well. And you can get that started, record a message, leave a number if you want to talk to us some more if this issue particularly affects you. Call in at 833-424-3327. Tell us what you think about the four T's: Trump, Trudeau, tariffs, and trade. Hope to hear from you. Stick around. There's more to come today on Central Time on the Ideas Network.